Welcome to the Product Quest podcast. Thank you for joining us on a journey to better understand innovation and product strategy. My name is Jan Vermouth, and joining me as always, my co-hosts Jonathan Edwards and Scott Burson. Today, we have Robin Bolton as our guest. Robin is the founder and chief navigator of Miles Zero, an innovation consultancy that works with leaders of medium and large businesses to navigate the uncertainty of innovation's fuzzy front end to confidently grow their businesses. Before founding Miles Zero, Robin was a partner at Innosight, the innovation and strategy firm that I think does not need an introduction, at least here, it doesn't need one, since it was created by Harvard professor Clayton Christensen. Robin worked at BCG and was a brand manager at P&G, where she was on a team, I find that super interesting, that developed and launched Swiffer and Swiffer WetJet. So plenty to go into here. Robin, welcome to the Product Quest podcast.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Right. So I want to jump in actually at the, I think the news that you sent this morning. Talk to us about baseball. Something good has happened, it sounds like.
Today is opening day for baseball in the US. And I am a lifelong baseball fan. And so for me, it always heralds, you know, that spring is coming. Summer is not far behind. And, you know, baseball gets a bad rap for being slow and traditional, but, you know, they've been changing things up in the last few years. So it's getting exciting.
Okay, great. So I remember vividly my first baseball game that I watched in the US, and I didn't think it was that boring. It's long. It's long.
It's long.
But I mean,
it's sort of comforting. I like to have, like, especially like a game on like the radio, or I'm just sort of listening, and because the action's not so fast, it sort of relaxes me. I don't know if you ever followed college baseball, but college baseball it'll break your heart because you can be winning 7-0 in the 8th inning and lose. So that can age you. But other than that, there's something peaceful about a baseball game. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially if you have a good announcer for your team, I follow the Cleveland Guardians. I love them. The announcer, Tom Hamilton, just hearing his home run call brings me joy every single time I hear it.
Yeah. Nice. By the way, I think I read in the preparation for today, somewhere you have an article on Moneyball and innovation. No, I think there is a blog post that you've written. So maybe there is even a link between innovation, or at least between Moneyball and innovation. So,
well, didn't one of our guests suggest Moneyball as one of the films?
Yeah.
I forget who it is now.
Yeah. It is a great film on innovation and how hard it is. There's a great line towards the end of the movie that's basically the first person through the wall is always the bloodiest. You know, for anyone who has innovated or tried to innovate, I have the scars.
They know the story.
Yep.
Well, maybe let's get you a little bit into the hard times of innovation, to be very honest. I mean, it's a bright day, at least here in Switzerland, but I think innovation labs are having a little bit of a hard time at the moment. So there's bad news even for some that are closing down. I think Google, Walmart, or there's a couple of big names that are shutting it down. In Switzerland, we had a couple of big insurances that kind of built up an innovation lab and they're closing down. So I know it's not a nice topic, but I think we need to go there. Like, how do you see that situation? Am I over-dramatizing it? What happened?
No, I think you're describing it very accurately. These things are shutting down. You know, the news of Walmart closing Store 8, which was their, you know, major incubator, some of the other companies you mentioned, it is a tough time for innovation labs. And like all news like that, I think it's kind of good and bad, so to speak. Oh, so, you know, bad news is that, as often happens kind of over the course of time, you know, companies' focus changes. The economy slows down, companies panic, they focus on their core business because that feels safer. You know, you also have to stabilize it, like that keeps the money coming in. But the first thing they go to is innovation and pulling resources from it. So it's very sad news in that way. It's also short-sighted because, like, you can't just turn innovation on and off. It's not a switch and be like, oh, well, we stopped and took a 3-year break, but let's just start again where we stopped. It's like, that's not how it works. The reason I see a slight silver lining on it is I think a lot of companies started innovation labs as theater. And it's like, oh, well, we're just going to set up our little, you know, outpost here, and they're going to do fun, cool things. And it was never approached with like the discipline and the strategic link and the expectations you have to produce value. It was just, it was set up as a hobby and it's met the fate of a hobby. Yeah. And so if it helps get companies focused back on like, no, innovation is a really, it's a critical strategic investment. We do need to expect results from it. We just need to approach getting those results in a different way. Then I think it's a good thing.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. I had a, like, at first I had this reaction of, oh no, now like now innovation is dead basically. But if it's kind of, it helps to bring back, I think, this important or this business critical aspect of innovation that I always felt it had and should have had, then maybe it's not that, I mean, it's not nice if you are in such an innovation lab and it happens. So that's no, but I think in general, I really like your answer. It's I if we can find now a way to prove its critical value, I think that would be exactly right. So that would be my way to go as an innovator. Do you have any other tips? What can you do if you're in a situation? Well, not if it is already closed, but if you are in this critical moment, basically, of you're on the line, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the first two things I look at is like, how does the work that's being done align with the company's strategies? It's like, how do you link into the bigger picture, the bigger priorities? And then what value can you point to right now? And it may be kind of qualitative stuff like, you know, a culture of a team has changed, or the process a team is using has changed and has gotten something out more quickly. So there may not be numbers, but like pointing to like, this has changed and this is better because of what we do.
Yeah.
It can buy you time.
Yeah. Right. So, well, maybe I think it would be good. The way I understand, at least the way you approach innovation, is exactly with this bringing value to the business perspective. So can you elaborate a little bit on well, the very big word that innovation is?
Yeah. So innovation, and I know you guys have all seen this, is like, it's such a buzzword. Everyone has their own definition. It's almost meaningless. And so the way I define it is, you know, it's something new that creates value. And value is like the most critical part of that definition. And value can look like a lot of different things. But I find, especially for, you know, when you're starting on an innovation effort, it's really important to define what that value is that you're trying to get to. And it's always interesting to me. Companies are really hesitant to do that. They kind of feel like, you know, I get a lot of feedback of like, oh, well, we don't want to constrain things. We don't want, like, no, constrain it.
Yeah.
Constraints drive creativity. Give me constraints.
Yeah.
And so like, let's be honest, most, you know, for-profit companies are for profit. So like, if you want something, you know, tell me what amount of profit you want from it or need from it. I'm not committing to it, but it helps me, like it gives me a target to shoot for and to help me kind of sort through project to be like, is this big enough to be worth it? Is it just interesting, but not big enough? And so, you know, I tend to take this very practical kind of, you know, I have been accused of being like a buzzkill about innovation. No, but we're doing this in a company and the company needs results. So like, let's be honest about that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's a good tip to kind of, as an innovator, learn to love your constraints. So to work in them, because I felt like what has happened over the past, I don't know, couple of years is a lot of the innovators fought for freedom and space, like don't push the pressure of the core business on me. And then they got the freedom. But they also got the problem of now they have to deliver, and apparently they some of them didn't, or didn't in the way that was at least intended. So I feel like there is this, suddenly you got a freedom and now what? And then you didn't bring value to the core. And I think that's, we kind of almost went too far away in a sense. I don't know if that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's happened. I mean, kind of going back to where we started with the innovation labs, I think that is something that happened to a lot of innovation labs. And, you know, I always remind the folks I work with, like, you know, just because we name a constraint now doesn't mean that it's set in stone and it is forever and it is in like you can't violate it. It's just a constraint. And if we find a good reason to push beyond it, we can change the constraint. It just means we need to come up with a really good reason, not a, hey, I just want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Robin, I know you've got some background in jobs to be done, and as do I. And, but, you know, this, I have to comment on this because when I've noticed when some folks sort of initially learn jobs to be done, they become so enthusiastic about it. It's like, oh, let's don't even worry about what our products are. Let's don't worry about what our solutions are. Let's just stay away from that. It's only what the customer is trying to accomplish. And I'm like, whoa, time out. We don't throw all that away. You know, that doesn't even make any sense. It's like you still have certain capability. So I find myself constantly talking people. Now, I'm a jobs be done advocate as big as there is, but I'm with folks that sort of get the religion. I'm constantly talking them down, trying to get them to focus to bring these constraints back in. I don't know if that's something that you've experienced as well.
Oh yeah, no, I like jobs to be done. As I say, jobs to be done is a hill that I will die on. Like I love it. I believe in its power. And you're right. Like if you're a company, you have capabilities and you operate in a specific industry and all that. Like, and so that gives you a right to play in a certain space and a right to win in a certain space. Yeah. So, you know, go find the jobs to be done and then ask the question, like, are we the best company? Are we the best people to solve that job? Yeah. Can we solve that job in a compelling way? But like just chucking it out the window, it's like, well, okay, that's fun, but that's a different company. Go work there.
that sounds like a startup, not like a big enterprise that is kind of evolving. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, it's fine. It's totally okay. But you know, every choice leads to a different choice. And so if you want to pursue, solve that job to be done in that way, go find someone equipped to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe there's one thing I want to touch upon before we get more into this jobs to be done stuff, because that's, I mean, okay. But anyway,
sorry.
So there is, no, that's perfect.
Scott and I are going to geek out. So pull us back.
No, well, you have a okay, now we're going there anyways. You have a beautiful blog that you've written about jobs done and also about AI and jobs to done. I think that is something that we also should be touching about. If you don't mind, could you quickly take us through it? Maybe let's start with, before we move in, with the question of where in your work does job to be done really play a role? Like when do you use it? When maybe you don't? And then we get more to this. Stuff.
Yeah. So I always use jobs to be done always at the beginning. And I use it kind of with, say, two audiences. One is the audience you'd expect. So talk to your customers, understand what their jobs to be done are, you know, functional, emotional, and social. And all three of those different jobs types. I also use it a lot with the internal stakeholders for the team, because before your idea or product ever gets to the customers, it has to survive the internal stakeholders.
Yes.
And so understanding what their jobs to be done are is just as important. Oh, sorry. Animation. I don't mean thumbs down.
Yeah.
Thumbs up.
Well, another reason to go on our YouTube channel, if I can plug it here, you will see thumbs up and thumbs down. But I completely agree. So most innovations probably die internally, not even externally, right?
So I saw a study, this is a couple of years ago, but it's like only 1 in 1,000 ideas actually get to market. And then we know the failure rate in market. So when you actually like extrapolate it out, it's something like 0.01% of ideas that start actually succeed in the market. And just even getting to it is kind of, you know, a challenge, shall we say.
Yes. So I find this really interesting. It's that kind of, you're trying to say, okay, well, there's internal stakeholders, think about what their job to be done is, and then that helps you in what way, kind of in selling basically the innovation to them, or?
Selling innovation to them. So I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was working at a client, they were developing a surgical robot. And there was one on the market who was dominating. So we were interviewing customers, hospital executives who had bought surgical robots, you know, to understand their jobs to be done. And we were talking to a CFO, so chief financial officer. And we said, okay, you know, you bought a robot. He was in charge of a small regional hospital in the US. It's like maybe two buildings, very small. And we said, but you bought the surgical robot, which is a huge, huge multi-million dollar investment. How many surgeries do you need to do to break even? And I'm making the numbers up. He's like, we have to do 400 surgeries a year using the robot to break even on it. So great. He's like, and we just bought our second robot. I'm like, that's amazing. You must be doing so many surgeries. How many are you doing? He said, we're doing 200. I majored in marketing because it was the least math intense area of study.
Something sounds weird there.
And so I was like, wait, check my math here. I'm like, you're doing 200, but you need to do 400 to break even on your first robot, but you bought the second one. Why? And his answer is like, do you know how popular I was after we got the first one? He's like, everybody loved me. And like, I went from being kind of Dr. No, the person you avoided at all costs, to being like everybody's favorite. And it felt great. And the thing, like, that is a story of, you know, from a customer perspective, but that exists within every company. Yes. And so that's why, like, getting to your stakeholder, your internal stakeholders' jobs to be done can really make or break how things go.
Yeah. That's a lovely example. I can imagine in big or small cases that happens a lot. And finally, the CFO is not the guy that says no all the time.
Yeah. So, and I get it.
Very nice. Well, okay. So so jobs done is a powerful way, obviously, that you apply and use quite often, quite extensively. I've seen you have a blog article on this. I should mention the website. The website is milezero.io. There's a blog on there. There's, well, blogs on there. And one is where you've kind of take us through how you played around a little bit with AI and jobs to be done. Is that correct? So, or can you tell us a little bit how you've approached it, what you've done?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've all seen all the press about AI. AI is coming for our jobs. AI is going to replace us. And we're like, all right, well, you know, let's see what this is going to do. And there are a lot of incredible resources out there. There's links to it in the blog post. But there was one amazing LinkedIn video where a gentleman who actually works at Walmart was talking about how they had used AI. And so, you know, I took copious notes, and using the prompts, basically in an hour and a half, created jobs to be done based personas for a client. Like four different, distinctly different personas for an area of study a client of mine was looking at. And I mean, building out the first draft of those personas would have taken easily 3 weeks of, you know, customer interviews, and then probably maybe another 2 weeks just to draft. So that's like 5 weeks of work in an hour and a half. Now, I will say that looking at it, it's like there's no way I would take those personas to client and be like, follow these. These are right.
Good.
I would never do that. But it was like, it was 80% right.
Yeah.
And what it enabled us to do was to adjust our approach to doing consumer research. So we rewrote the interview guide. So we spent more time on filling in that 20% that the AI couldn't tell us, because you know, all the large language models, all the AI, they're trained on things. So they can only tell you what exists and what is known. And despite social media, people aren't putting their like insecurities and aspirations and all of that out there to be fed into an LLM. You have to actually talk to a person and build rapport so that they kind of confess the, you know, like the CFO, like, I was really popular. So yes, I spent $15 million to be popular again.
I hope you have to have a that on the forum somewhere.
So you have to actually talk to people to get that insight, to get that 20%. But that 20% is where like 100% of the innovation comes from. So what I found is that AI is an amazing tool to start with. You can't end there because you won't have anything new that everybody else doesn't already know. But it can help you more efficiently, more quickly get to that 20% where all of the gold is.
Yeah, so I don't know what the other experiences was, but we played around with it as well in somewhat similar circumstances, and we kind of tried to. So what we did is we tested it basically against actual job sit down interviews. So before we went to the interviews, we tried to what does AI give us and what do the interests give us? Well, now you kind of just have to believe me, but we'll try to publish as much as we can. There was one aspect of it which really scared me. I think I completely agree. It's quite quick to get you ahead. But there was a portion of insights that I would have loved to be true, but weren't. So let me quickly explain. So the project was in medical, and the target group were doctors. And AI came up with all that stuff about caring for the patient and making sure that they're not nervous, that they don't feel pain, and that the family is at ease and all that kind of stuff. Now, I don't want to be mean to doctors, but that just was never mentioned as an issue at all. When you talk to them, it's about the medical care, and wouldn't we all love like the doctors that, I'm not saying they don't, but I think they do it in a different way. So there's also, I feel, this danger in AI of, it gives you answers that you would love to have, but aren't true. I don't know if that.
Yeah, no, that's the, you have to check AI.
Yes.
And again, a very, very small example, not related to jobs to be done at all, but I think it stresses the importance of double checking AI is in my spare time, I teach in a master's program in Boston. And one of my students, bless her heart, she sent me a note saying she couldn't come to class because she had injured her wrist over the weekend, had to go to the ER, get stitches. And her doctor told her she had to be on bed rest for the rest of the week. I was like, bed rest for wrist injury? Send me that doctor's note and I will excuse you from class. And later that day, she showed up to class. And I'm like, yep, AI wrote your email to me. Double check it.
Wow, that's a nice one. Right. Okay. So, I want to get back to a little bit the innovation stuff because, well, it sounds like maybe I'm now mischaracterized. Oh, well, of course I am, but it sounds like super easy. So, there's just an innovations ABC, three little things that you need to do. Can you tell us a little bit? What they? Of course, I'm joking here, but there is a nice way of how you describe what innovation takes, which is the innovations ABC. Can you quickly walk us through what that is and why it's important?
Yeah. So the ABCs stand for architecture, behavior, and culture. And so the architecture are the things that I think we all talk about, you know, talked about for decades of you need an innovation process, you need a structure, you need a governance, you need a strategy, all of that very business stuff. And yes, but I found over the decades of doing this, that stuff is necessary, but not sufficient to successfully innovate. You need that, and you need behaviors and primarily leadership behaviors that really encourage innovation, that support innovation despite economic downturns, despite kind of fear within the C-suite around, oh my gosh, we need to retreat and kind of focus on our core. So you need leaders to engage in very specific ways and specific behaviors. Yeah. And you need a culture within the company that at the beginning, at least, is not hostile to innovation. Ideally, you would have a culture of innovation and one that's supportive and sees the value. What I found in most companies is innovation, especially when you get like, again, the labs or the like the cool offices, it becomes an us versus them.
Yeah.
And that is bad news for innovation. You need people to at least be like, yeah, fine, go innovate. We support you. Good job. Then grow from there into a culture where innovation and, you know, the approach to problem solving, the customer focus, all of those elements are part of how you do business. It's part of the culture.
Yeah.
So you need all three of those things, the architecture, the behaviors, and the culture, all working together and evolving together to really get, you know, the results that innovation can and does need to deliver for a business.
Yeah. That's very nice. I think I want to especially emphasize also the leadership part. I feel like sometimes kind of leadership thinks architecture is where there they show their engagement, right? So that, and when they, then that's done, then innovation's done, but it takes so much more. So given the circumstances today, what can leaders do to kind of still protect, to keep that muscle going through those difficult times?
So in a sentence, leaders need to make irrational decisions. And so, yeah, just go do crazy stuff. You'll be fine. So I have a lot of empathy for leaders because, you know, you put yourself in their shoes. They have limited resources. You know, they have a limited budget. They have a limited number of people. And they know if, you know, I spend a dollar or a euro or allocate a person to my core business, I know what I'm going to get and I know when I'm going to get it. You allocate that dollar, euro, or person to innovation, you may get nothing. And if you get something, you don't know when that's coming in. And in this context, then the leader has numbers they have to deliver for their business. Their job, their paycheck, their bonus is based on delivering those numbers. And so, you know, I think I won't speak for you, but if I put myself in their shoes, like, of course they're going to allocate scarce resources to where they know they're going to get a return.
Yeah.
And, you know, given that most people are in their roles 2, maybe 3 years, even if you were bold enough to invest in innovation, the results, the benefits of your risk are going to pay off when you're in a different chair. Someone else is going to get that benefit. So of course, like, the logical decision is to invest in the core business.
Yeah.
Robin,
sorry, for all sorts of reasons.
I just have to jump on that point because I've heard so many innovation practitioners just opine and complain about leaders and, oh, they only make short-term decisions. They just work for Wall Street. And I'm like, this is a very simple problem to understand. Look at how they are compensated. This is not difficult. And if there were some number of $1 million that I was going to get for propping up that number, that's a heck of an incentive. I'm not going to tell you I wouldn't act in a similar way. And what you just said, I feel like I've been shouting from the mountaintops and then people stare at me and they're like, yeah, but they make short-term decisions. And I'm like, okay, I can't even have this conversation anymore because just follow the metrics, follow the money. It's like you said, for them to take these risks for what? For they're going to be in a position a couple of years. If they get fired, they're going to get paid tons of money to get fired. And if they're right, then just their successor benefits. It makes me happy to hear you say that, because I feel like people opine as if it's very complicated. And to me, it seems very simple. And you just laid it out there perfectly.
And we have the same problem in politics, by the way. Elected officials have the same kind of issue. It's
spot money. On. I mean, the short-termism affects everything. And like, we want to think we're these greater, like, evolved beings. And it's like, no, if you incentivize me to do that, I will do it.
That's right. That's right.
Like, I get it. And so that's why I started with, like, leaders need to be irrational and illogical and actually make choices against their own interests. And the leaders that I have seen do it, it's because a priority for them is their legacy and they're investing in their legacy, but they are also very well aware of, like, I could get fired.
Yeah.
And they've kind of made peace with that, which is not an easy thing to do.
I think this helps explain the success of founder-led companies. Jeff Bezos, you know, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. Think of people that Jeff Bezos basically, you know, did not care about Wall Street and just thumbed his nose at the metrics. But buy the stock, don't buy the stock, I don't care. And then you look at those companies, you know, Amazon, Apple, Tesla. I forget the guy's name, Armstrong, that I think runs Coinbase. But that, anyway, to me, that can help explain why how these founder-led companies just blow away any other CEO situation.
Yep. And private companies, too.
Yes. Yes.
The ones that aren't subject to the quarterly reports and the pace and the emotion of Wall Street.
Yeah. But I love that as an advice. I think it's really, it's you have to somehow care about a different goal than the short-term stuff. But that will, I think, over the long term of your life, that will pay out.
Yep.
At least I hope so.
But it's it's hard. Like, right. Yeah. I mean, you have bills to pay today. So it's a huge challenge.
Yeah. Maybe staying with your approach or how you go about also working with the people, there is five core beliefs that you mentioned on your website. And I want to run through them and especially touch upon a couple of those. And if you want to comment and then feel free to, but I think it's really showing how you are also kind of, if I may say, like a belief driven about innovation. Mm-hmm. So let me go through the five beliefs and then I have some questions. So the five core beliefs that you mentioned are the following. The first one is innovation is something different that creates value. Second one, innovation requires curiosity, courage, and commitment. The third one, any organization can innovate and any person can be an innovator. I really like that. And then I think it just gets better and better. And the fourth one, people, even your customer and your boss, decide with their hearts and justify with their heads. And then the fifth one is ideas are a dime a dozen, decisions are priceless, action is perfection.
Yep.
So maybe in a very broad sense, can you tell us a bit of the story about why do you think it was important to have these core beliefs? Like, where do the beliefs come from?
Yeah, they came from, I recognize essentially, like, these are things that I say all the time in conversations with folks. And so I just, you know, kind of started taking notes of like, what are these things that I say all the time, you know, either to kind of introduce myself in my work, explain the approach we're taking, reassure people when we're kind of in the journey and things are looking a little wobbly, because that's part of it. And it really broke down to those five things. And really at the heart of it is just a recognition, like, we're all humans. You know, we all kind of feel like we put on, you know, I'm going to business and I'm going to go be whatever your title is. It's like, yeah, but still a human. And kind of recognizing the humanity that is the work we do, that are, you know, the people that we work with. And so, you know, like one of them is that any company can innovate, any person can be an innovator, but not everybody wants to be.
Yeah.
And that's okay. So, you know, like so many companies, and I feel like this is less and less, which is a good thing, was like everybody at the company is an innovator. Yes, they have the capability of being an innovator, but some people really love to be experts at what they do and live in absolute certainty and operate like champs. And every business needs operators. So let them do that. Let them do what they want to do and they're amazing at. And the people who want to innovate, let them do that. And so it's like, let people do the work they love to do. And if that's innovation, support them in that. Yeah. And then again, kind of like, you know, decide with your heart, justify with your head. That's a CFO.
Or I really the CFO. Like that. I mean, that's...
You know, when that it took me a while to recover from that interview because I'm like, that just happened. Okay. And it's true. And I've seen it play out over and over and over again. And so kind of recognizing that, you know, when you run into a decision, you know, even with your boss, that doesn't make sense, No, it makes sense to them. So why? What else is going on in their head? What are the emotional and social jobs to be done that are actually driving the decision?
That's so nice. Can I jump in here quickly?
Yeah.
Because I was wondering if this designing with the hearts and justifying with the heads for you is it at odds with jobs to be done, or is it something that comes out of jobs to be done? Because you could have, or some people give jobs to be done a spin where it's like, well, it's forget the heart, it's about the head, and it's giving you a functional reason in order to blah, blah, blah. So, but it seems for you like that it's not an odds at all. It's in the theory of jobs to be done itself, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, you got it perfectly. For me, jobs to be done really unlocked a lot of things. You know, like I said, you know, so often I would run into decisions that did not make sense to me. I would look at the leader and be like, you were choosing, you know, a process at the company, you're choosing something over the business, and I don't understand. And what I learned about jobs to be done, and especially the emotional and social, is like, it's the emotional and social jobs that are driving their decisions, you know, what their aspirations are, what their motivations are, how they want to be perceived. But nobody wants to admit those things because we're all supposed to be, you know, proper business logical people. And so they make this decision and then they search for the data, the functional jobs to justify what they have decided. And we all do that. Like, that's why even in jobs to be done interviews, when you talk to someone, the first things you hear are always functional jobs. Well, you know, I want a car that goes fast and that gets great gas mileage and, you know, this and this. You know, another great example was doing work with an automaker, and we were talking to a woman who sustainability, incredibly important to her. I mean, and her home, like, they recycled everything, they composted, they didn't buy anything new. Everything was, you know, purchased secondhand. And then we went into her garage and there was a yellow Humvee. It's like, well, this would be the opposite of sustainability. But when we asked why, she literally didn't see the conflict, because it all came down to taking care of her children. And so all of the sustainability and everything was taking care of her children by making sure the planet is healthy for them when they grow up. But on the streets of LA, taking care of her children is driving around in a tank.
And
so understanding that, like, the emotional and social is what makes the decisions, it's the functional that justifies it. It's like seeing the Matrix. When you figure that, you're like, oh, that's how this works.
Yeah, I love this. People decide with their hearts and justify with their heads. In all your writing, you're very concise. I love it. You've got quite a skill for saying a lot with few words. I had gone down the rabbit hole of decision making, and there was a neuroscientist, Antonio Damasio, and he had a patient, or had studied the situation where a gentleman had brain damage and had lost access to his emotions. And he had all his intellect, all his IQ, all that, but without access to emotions, he could not decide what to eat for lunch. He could not decide how to file anything. He could not decide whether to brush his teeth or take a shower in the morning. Without access to his emotions, he could not make the simplest of decisions, because he was stuck with only his rational mind. And anyway, so his conclusion was that, and again, it's jobs be done, it just helps us to sort of understand this world. It doesn't refute it. Like, certainly this gentleman that had the damage, he knew functionally things he wanted to accomplish. So that's the function. But without access to his emotion, he couldn't even make the simplest of decisions. And what I just love about, and really it's all your writing, but how you just explained that rather complicated reality with, I don't know, what is that, like 8 or 9 words? People decide with their hearts and justify with their heads. So, and also, by the way, while innovation, something new that creates value, again, very concise, very accurate. You've got quite a talent for communicating.
Thank you. It is, I assure you, the first drafts were not nearly as concise, but that's why we do drafts, right? We run the experiments.
An iterative process.
Yep.
Yeah.
I want to emphasize something that you so, sorry. Well, I want to emphasize something that you mentioned there, kind of in between the two sentences, which I really, now you made me realize something about jobs done as well. I think it's, you said, well, it's a tool that makes you understand other things that would otherwise not make sense to you. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that rings very true with me. I think it's people, of course, I'm including myself and everybody in the call, but people have generally a very hard time thinking like somebody else. Usually we don't, that's not something we usually do. Usually we just think.
Yeah.
And it's not in our whatever nature, I have no clue, but we tend to do rarely thinking in kind of from the perspective of somebody else. It's not something that we do often. And I think now that you're listening to you, jobs to be done is like a tool to at least get close to it. Maybe you don't hit it perfectly, but it allows you to make sense of some, you said it allows me to make sense of something I otherwise don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a personality trait where like I can be very judgmental. Like it's not a great personality trait. But with jobs to be done, it keeps me curious because as soon as I hear something that doesn't make sense, you know, my instinct is to be like, well, you know, that's wrong. You're an idiot. Like, you know, instant judgment. But knowing, like, just having that framework of jobs to be done is like, wait a minute. No, this does make sense to them. I just don't understand why. And so just that tool to keep me curious,
yeah,
I have found to be so helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I want to go to the fifth one. So there, I mean, I think that's a rabbit hole in itself. I want to go to the fifth one because I think that maybe touches upon issues that we had before. So I issues we talked about before. Ideas are a dime a dozen. Can you elaborate a little bit on that one? I want that as a sticker to put everywhere.
Yeah, it's tough. Like I don't want people to think that I think ideas are unimportant. Ideas are critical. Like we're all filled with ideas. And because every person is filled with ideas and every company is filled with people, every company has more ideas than they could ever act on.
Yeah.
The challenge becomes like, are people sharing their ideas? Do people know what ideas are most valuable to share versus not? Do people know how to share ideas in a constructive way so that they're heard and acted on? So, you know, so often companies will come to me and be like, we need help with innovation. We don't have enough ideas. I'm like, oh no, you have more ideas than you know what to do with. How do we get them out? How do we get the right ideas? And, you know, the rest of the, you know, decisions and action, when ideas get out, like, and I see this a lot in like hackathons and shark tanks, where people have ideas and they work on them and there's a lot of support. And then it's kind of like, wah, wah. The event is over, go back to your day job. It's like, wait, but what decisions were made? What's going to happen next? Are we acting on this? Like, and it all goes back to like, innovation creates value. An idea that doesn't get acted on can't create value.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you need ideas. And you need the decisions and the actions that enable the idea to actually create value and become an innovation. And so many, again, kind of innovation efforts, especially big companies, focus on the idea stage and that's it.
Yeah. So I imagine you would need some kind of pipeline then to keep these ideas in and then also throw out some ideas potentially that don't work. So I was just, as you were talking, I was just wondering, so say you have a hackathon and there's different projects that are done. How would you then at some point eliminate the bad ideas and keep the, so as you're going along, how do you start judging on which are the ideas to keep and not to keep then?
Yeah, it's a great question. So especially with hackathons and shark tanks, I always think they should start with, you know, at least some guidance of, hey, we're looking for ideas that help us here, here, and here. Because I vividly remember working with a company that they put in an innovation software. They wanted to capture ideas. And the ideas that came in were ideas like, let's change the bags from blue to white. Like,
yes.
Okay. Like, you know, and then there were literally thousands of ideas we had to go through that just were never going to go anywhere. So starting with some sort of focus, and then, you know, to your question around how do you keep kind of focusing the pipeline, it kind of goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of, you know, what do you need the innovation to deliver? And, you know, especially in the beginning when you're still developing, it's like, can I tell a story? Well, this will be a $100 million idea. Like, I can't prove to you it will be, but can I tell a story that it will be? And then can I tell a better story? Do I have data to support my story? And kind of, you know, increasing the burden of proof as you get closer and closer to market, but always kind of with that eye on, like, can we hit the target?
Yeah. I really liked it because I think a lot of those methods that are, well, methods or approaches to innovation that are out there, they start with let's generate ideas. Yeah. And that's, I feel like that's starting at the wrong place. I feel like it's not bad to have ideas, right? So same as you, I mean, somewhere some things need to come from, and usually these are ideas, but I think in past 10 years, 15 years that I'm doing this, never have I ever met a company with too few ideas. Never. It's just
never.
The problem is which of these, like 1,000 are there. What are the three that are actually relevant? I remember another one. So I don't know if this was going to happen, but I'm promoting your blog all the time. So anyway, there is another story on your blog that I really recommend people to go to. I'll put some links in the description. About these, and I think it maybe goes into the same broader topic of ideas and innovation, about the Adobe Kickbox story. Yeah. Yes. You basically ended on an open note. So maybe can you maybe quickly run us through the story and have you reached a more clearer conclusion by now?
Yep. So quick background on Adobe Kickbox. This is something that Adobe first started with in, I think it was 2012, and they really tested for 2 years. And now it's been spun off as a nonprofit. So many companies, organizations use it. It's an incredible tool. So what the Kickbox is essentially, it's a short size box that contains everything you need to test an idea, to bring an idea to life. And so, you know, it has a process and, you know, tools and cards that you can use. It has post-it notes, it has pens, it has notebooks, it has a Starbucks gift card, because goodness knows you need caffeine for this. It has a chocolate bar, because also you need chocolate when you do this kind of work. And it has a $1,000 prepaid gift card. And you don't have to, like, submit receipts. There's no paperwork. Just here's $1,000. Go buy what you need. And when Adobe first was trialing it, their first launch of it, they gave out 1,000 kickboxes. That's $1 million just in gift cards.
Yeah.
And I cannot think of many companies that will be like, yeah, for our first experiment, let's spend $1 million, you know, more than $1 million when you factor in the cost of developing it. But it, that's what Adobe did. And it's key, I think, that the chief evangelist, who's also their head of strategy, was championing the Kickbox. So they had someone in the C-suite.
Internally? This was distributed
just internally.
Internal, Okay.
Yep. And people could sign up. So it wasn't like, hey, we're going to go, you know, push this out to the marketing team. They just said, hey, this is an option. If you want a box, you let us know. And so I was looking at Kickbox and, you know, it's lived on. It's now, you know, more than 10 years old. It's, like I said, it's being used in all sorts of companies and nonprofits and governments. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah.
Swisscom is one of them. So as a Swiss, you have to mention that. So.
Yes, you have to mention that. Yeah. Oh, and sorry. So I was debating with a friend of, like, is Kickbox successful?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I look at it and say, well, what business results? Like, is there revenue? Is there product? Can you tie numbers to that? And his perspective was, but it changed the culture of Adobe. And it was a great point he made. And what it did is it kind of, like, Ooh, well, what is success for innovation? And, you know, as I've continued to think about it, I think it's success is what you define it to be, but you need to define it up front. Yeah. You know, if they had said Kickbox needs to lead to innovations that generate, I don't know, 100 million in revenue, then Kickbox wasn't successful. I think the way Adobe defined it, which from everything I read wasn't like a conscious definition, but in kind of hindsight, like it changed the culture. Yeah. And you can then say, okay, well, if you change the culture, then you probably have lower retention. You have, you know, it's easier to attract talent. So there are all these kind of knock-on benefits of a great culture that you can then translate into money. But for me, it's like, well, what did you intend it to do?
Yeah.
And if the intention was culture, you nailed it. If the intention was to come up with the next billion-dollar brand, not so much. Yeah. But define the success up front and then go after it.
But what I find interesting about this is I wonder if they had upfront decided to change their culture, they would have come up with this box.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I mean, I think it's interesting that the executive who led the initiative had joined Adobe through acquisition. So he had actually been CEO of a startup that Adobe had purchased. So he came in with that outside perspective, which is, I think, probably what, to your point, enabled him to think very differently than how Adobe and a big corporate core would have approached the culture question.
Yeah. But I think that's a, so I like this kind of, that you're leaving it in ambiguity there. So almost this instant judgment saying, well, but that's a wasteful process. Because it sounds super waste. I mean, you're engaging all these thousands of employees or 1,000 employees, and then nothing happens. So, but maybe stuff changes. So, you move the goalpost of what's possible, and that's, I mean, I have a hard time imagining what that feels like. But doing that on a large scale is super hard, and measured by that, a million might not be that much. And it's probably better. Right. So here I'm having a lot of judgment, but it's probably better than just pure culture stuff. Let's say, mm-hmm. I feel like changing culture through something like that is probably likely to be more effective than I don't know, writing a culture paper or whatever else that people do in that space.
Yep, 100%, 100%.
Right. So I kind of want to, as Scott would say, Lent is playing slowly. Besides your blog that I've mentioned now a couple of times, so it's on milezero.io. That's the website. I think that's certainly a good place to start and go find more about. Where should people go to find more about you, about Mile Zero, and where do you want them to go?
Yeah. So the website, Mile Zero's website, milezero.io, is the perfect place to start. In addition to the blog, you can sign up for a monthly newsletter. I feel like newsletter is such an old term, but I don't have a better one. And you know, that one just has a little bit more, more thoughts. It also has pictures of Lego minifigs, which I've been told is the main draw. So it's very cute pictures of little Lego figures. And so you can sign up for that. And then I also post daily on LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah. I can really recommend the newsletter. So I usually once a year, I kind of screen all my newsletters and kick those out that I don't like. So just to have my inbox a little bit clean, I guarantee you yours will stay. So I recommend that people go there. Well, Robin, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. This was so great. So fun.
Hey, Jan, before we completely land that plane, I have one last question, or maybe the last question. So, Robin, I know you worked at Intersight with Dr. Christensen, you know, somebody that's, I don't know what I'd be doing professionally if not for his contributions. What can you tell us about him or your experiences working with him that might be of interest to a fan like we are?
Yeah.
So I've heard him described as a gentle giant, and that is the single best description of him. He was an extremely tall man, but he was so gentle and patient and genuinely curious. He had a sign up either in his office or, you know, above his office door. It's anomalies welcome.
Mm. Oh.
And very few experts, academics are open to anomalies because it threatens their thinking.
Yeah.
And he sought them out and he was eager to hear them and he was eager to have people push back on his theories. And I think that humility and that curiosity is what made him so impactful.
Well, that's, I think, a great place to. I really enjoyed the time. Thank you so much, Robin, for taking the
Thank
time.
Thank you.
And that concludes today's Product Quest podcast. So please send any comments or ideas for future shows to productquestpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, see you next time.
Okay. Thank you so much. Fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Have a good day. Here.